Support for 51% comes from the Master of Arts in Teaching program at Bard College, offering master's degrees and teacher certification in 1 year, graduate study and extensive public school residencies combined with small class sizes, and a focus on the learner as an individual. Now accepting applications, teaching what matters, bard.edu/mat/ny.
On this week's 51%, we bring you an interview with best-selling author and poet Sapphire. You'll hear about her novels, social consciousness, and thoughts on the presidential election.
We cannot allow this country to go back to the 1950s. It may have been idyllic for white men in the 1950s, but in the 1950s, I couldn't drink from the same water fountain as a white child.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Best-selling author Sapphire recently appeared at SUNY Ulster, a State University of New York community college in Ulster County, as part of a writer's series. Sapphire's first novel, Push, about a heavyset African-American, illiterate, HIV-positive teen abused by her parents, impregnated by her father, was made into the 2009 Academy Award-winning film Precious. Her second novel, a 2011 follow-up to Push, is The Kid. Christina Jowers is a SUNY Ulster student.
I've been waiting to meet Sapphire for 20 years. I was 13 when I got the book Push, and when I seen that we were holding a series here and a reading for her, I was beyond excited.
She says it was all worth the 20-year wait, and Sapphire, through her talk and readings, inspired Jowers even more to be successful and help bring about social change.
Being here and hearing her talk about Push gave me more of a push than I already had. I initially had the push from the book, you know, being 13 and being in an environment. I come from Red Hook Projects in Brooklyn, so, you know, I've seen a lot. And reading a book like that, it was like, oh, okay, there's someone else out there that can resonate, that I you know, look at my neighbors and say, oh, you... Shaquana knows what I'm going through because she lives on a block. You know, somebody else that's writing about the things that girls are going through or just living in a low-income environment, you know, and just knowing that through all adversities, you can make it. You can make it. I'm living proof.
Jowers is studying business and entrepreneurship and plans to open a catering business. Kim Wozencraft teaches English at SUNY Ulster.
We can be a kind of isolated, pale community up here, and to have artists from other areas come in and share their work and talk about really, really important issues on top of just sharing their work opens up a dialogue and maybe causes a few people to think twice about, I mean, I know it makes me think about what's going on, not just in the community, but in the nation and in the world as a whole. And it was really a great opportunity to have an open dialogue with somebody who's obviously thought deeply and critically about all these issues.
After the talk, reading, and autograph signing, I spoke with Sapphire about topics ranging from her reflection upon the film, social causes, and the results of the presidential election.
You were asked a couple of questions about when the book, when Push became Precious, and what artistic right you still had, or what was being run by you in the agreement of that. So at one point you say, you know, it's out of your hands, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they understand,
really,
hey, it's a film. It's not the book. It's the film. What was in it for you? Why did you want, did you say, okay, I'm going to let that go. I understand what's at stake here. What was so important for you to get out?
I think at the time, before the movie was made, Push had sold something like 270,000 copies, which is a lot, you know. After the movie came out, Push went into the category of selling over 1 million copies. So it meant a much wider readership, you know. I mean, people saw the movie, they came back, they bought the book. The ideas that were talked about in the book, some of them made it to the movie, and so it reignited this conversation that still needed to be talked about. the literacy movement is ongoing, and I think, you know, given the immigrant population, the ESL movement, all these things needed government funding, and I think the movie showed the power of alternative education, and the book showed the power of alternative education. And then we also had in the book, even though it's commonplace now, it's the first mainstream discussion of the heterosexual transmission of the HIV virus to this young girl. And so that was groundbreaking at the time, and it still needed to be discussed in the movie, and that was important. So that these issues would get wider attention, and that the book would have a bigger audience, was important to me.
Did you see any social change?
I definitely saw social change. I guess it was around 2013, and I'm not sure the exact date, but it's been recently. The Atlanta Center for Disease Control said for the first time in the history of the HIV movement, the rate of heterosexual transmission in Black women went down. And I remember I just closed my eyes and said, I'm a part of that. My work was a part of that. And all the bad reviews or the negativity around the issues in the book, some people felt it was overexposure of private issues or whatever. I said, Push was a part of that. And I felt just proud.
What about the kid? What are you seeing in the aftermath of the kid?
One of the things that happened with Push is that people would come up to me, social workers, teachers, women, and say, I've had experiences like that. And that rarely happened to me with the kid. And I was in Chicago, and a young man came up to me, but he waited until everybody else was gone, and there was just me and him there. And he said, that happened to me too. So what we do know about men is that early childhood abuse affects them almost as much as it does women. But it's taken not only as an assault on their personhood, it's taken as assault on their manhood and their masculinity. So they are far less likely to admit it. The depths to which the character Abdul descends at some point are horrifying in some ways. And when I was in St. Louis, I believe it was, I was doing a reading, and two professional women came up to me and said, we see people like that every day. And so I thought, are you social workers? Because that was the type of people who would come up to me with Push. And she says, no, we're death row lawyers. And when we are reviewing these men's cases, the things you describe in the kid are what happened to these men. And I was... Of course, I was astounded.
Now, you had mentioned that that's a theme you're looking into now. You're pretty appalled at what's going on in our prison system, and in healthcare, medical care, and I certainly can relate to that mm-hmm. part too. So, is that what you're looking at in terms of prose?
Right now, I'm looking a lot at the lives. I'm writing a novel which details the lives of two women from their early adolescence into their 50s and 60s. And so we're really seeing how decisions that were made in terms of access to birth control, access to healthcare early in their life, we see it in Push, and we see, of course, in the beginning of the kid, what the healthcare decisions or the things that impacted her health-wise resulted in. But I really wanted to look at it even more deeply in terms of how this underrepresentation of African-American women in terms of receiving healthcare has had a dire impact on their later lives. And I always thought of someone who I always thought could have been the first woman president, would have been Barbara Jordan, but she was dead at 60. And so that's a common something that we're seeing a lot in African American women.
How important was it for you to come in front of a bunch of college students as well as high school students and some mm-hmm. community members, mm-hmm. right? A real mix, as who you are, as an African American author, as a poet, as there's a degree of activism in what you do. So how important was it to you to send your message here?
Well, I couldn't know, you know, when I accepted the job that, you know, the election result. But what I was telling someone else, I knew driving up here that even if it wasn't turmoil, that no matter which side of the, which party or which candidate people had voted for, there was bound to be a measure of psychological turmoil. And I really wanted to present my art, but I also wanted to speak to that issue of activism and as opposed to apathy, you know, action as opposed to just burning anger. And I felt such an alive energy from the students and the other members of the audience who weren't students but teachers and community members. And so that, I was aware of that, and I wanted to not miss that opportunity to be a part of this moment, because I think that we're in a good crisis in that people are awake and alive and realize that something to their liking has not happened. And there's going to be some analysis, and there's also going to be some kickback. And more than anything, people are not going to, people went to sleep during the Bush years. You know what I mean? You know, the protests against the Iraq war were futile. And then we had to look back at mass death in Guantanamo and just horror after horror, and I think it numbed people. Whereas I see people very alive now. I see people are really kicking back and trying to figure out what are we going to do to make sure that this right turn is not permanent. What are we going to do to stay a centrist course? And I feel energized. You know what I mean? I've been, you know, everyone is calling me and emailing me and texting me, and I just feel like we're going to come through this, you know.
Despite the what's been said from him and his campaign about race, about Muslims, about immigrants, I mean, you name it, the bigotry was there, the racism was there, and the misogyny
was
there.
I think that's part of what I was saying to the students. He has played, he's played people, you know what I mean? He's literally played upon their fears. But he said some things in terms of, he said he would bring jobs back. Well, bring the jobs back, you know what I mean? And so, of course, that's going to be a real issue. He's going to have difficulty doing that because he doesn't know how to do that, you know what I mean? And he's going to have to ask for help, and he's an egomaniac, so he'll probably have some trouble reaching out to people to find out how to create jobs, you know? I mean, Obama could tell him because Obama did create jobs. But when he finds himself up against the wall, what Trump will do is turn to his soft targets, which is misogyny, racism, and, you know, anti-Islamic everything, you know what I mean? And that's what we can't allow him to do. We have to keep telling him, we want jobs. We want the jobs that you created. We want your miracle health system. Okay, you know, we've got the hate thing. We know how to do that as a nation. Now let's go beyond it. And we have to not be, those who voted for him have to demand their jobs, their medical care, and they have to not just be satisfied with a license to hate. You know, that now you've got a man whose father was in the Ku Klux Klan and who the Ku Klux Klan supports. Okay, you've got your man, okay? But now can he deliver more than hatred?
Because as you said, he won fairly. And he
Yeah.
So, but I wanted to ask you, I was very struck by one thing. In your reading, the difference in how you read from the kid versus how you read your own poetry. Mm-hmm. And obviously one is, as you described, your poetry is more autobiographical and your novel's not. Although I read something very interesting about an interview with you where it was assumed at the beginning that Push was autobiographical.
People thought I was Precious. Yeah, yeah. So that was, there was nothing I could do about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but in that vein, I felt you read with it, just the reading was different because mm-hmm. it was autobiographical, or at least a portion of it. I certainly don't know mm-hmm. exactly what mm-hmm. portion. Is that a way for you to have that outlet in both ways? Deliver your social message via the novels.
Right.
Get the writing, you know, all of that creative writing,
exactly.
Social causes. But then here's what happened to me, and I choose to process as a writer.
Exactly.
So poetry, is that
exactly.
It?
Yeah, the poetry is very different. And I was speaking to earlier about also the active journal writing. So the poetry is one step beyond the journal writing, and then I do a lot of journal writing, which is totally private. So a lot of my thought processes, my analysis of the world, my feelings are processed through writing. Some of it is publishable, some of it is only publishable in small journals, and some of it is appeals to many, many people. And so I accept that, and I think there's different reasons for it, but I also feel that as I honor my own voice, it allows me to step back and honor the voices of other women. So in other words, I don't go in Barnes & Noble and look at the bestseller list and get my books there. Sometimes, but so I'm really looking for the other women poets. I'm really looking for social activists. I'm really looking in small journals for poems and stuff like that. And it changes my perspective as opposed to if I was just focused on the novel, you know what I mean? Or so-called great literature. So I'm looking at it all as great literature, you know, and that we can learn from all kind of writing. I mean, we know that Beloved, Toni Morrison's novels, that some of that was literally taken from, not taken from, but she got the inspiration from these barely literate slave narratives. So those are people's writing is, to me, is the foundation of any socially conscious work. Yeah.
If you could put this book into the hands of somebody who you know hasn't touched this book, who would you like to deliver that to or push?
I would like to, always with the books, I'd like them to get to the most vulnerable reader, the reader who may be experiencing that or who that may have been their experience. But I also want to get it to people who have power. And we don't, professors and teachers, we don't often look at ourselves as people at power, but we do. We can recommend books, we can give out books, you know, we can begin to, I taught at Trinity and I taught a class on women writing in journals, and I had a white Brazilian student in my class, and we read the Catalina de Jesus's journal, Diary of the Dark, about a woman of the favelas who wrote her journal on the back of trash. And this kid, his mother had enough, family had enough money to send him to a $30,000 a year school, said, "I never knew people in Brazil live like that." And I'm thinking, how could this be? Because I've been to Brazil and I saw it. But somehow he never saw it until he read this book.
What in your mind is the state of women, and it take it another level, African-American women in this country?
Well, one thing we can look at is that I'm really proud of African-American women, despite the fact that the policies during the Clinton era hurt us badly. The the three strikes and the mass incarceration, these were part of Bill Clinton's ideology. Also, ending welfare as we know it, these were horrific things. But even given that, 94% of African American women voted for Hillary Clinton versus 53% of white women voted for Trump. So even given the divisiveness of Clinton and some of the bad track record that she has had, enough African American women realized that she had enough progressive qualities that she was a far better candidate than Donald Trump. So in that sense, I think our persistent socioeconomic position on the bottom has kept our eyes open. And so in that way, I feel energized. And I think that we will not just survive this this 4 years with this guy. We will become even more active, and we will get this guy out in 2020. And we will also, be vigilant to make sure that as much progress as we have made, that no one turns back the hands of time. I mean, if this guy can throw out Roe Wade, then he can throw out the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Act and all these things, and we cannot allow that to happen. We cannot allow this country to go back to the 1950s. It may have been idyllic for white men in the 1950s, but in the 1950s, I couldn't drink from the same water fountain as a white child. Okay, so it was not heaven, you know. In the 1950s, blacks were not allowed in all these jobs they keep talking about that they lost. We never had them. We never had them. We weren't allowed in the unions. Maybe it was great for some people, but we're not going to allow this country to go back to the past.
Role models to me are so important, mm-hmm. And I think they are for women in particular, particularly women of color, immigrant, you name mm-hmm. it. I just mm-hmm. think women need to see there's somebody like them
exactly.
doing what they want to do. And obviously you had some African-American women in your audience. One in particular struck mm-hmm. me and was very struck by your presence here and inspired. So when you see that and you see how inspired even just a handful can be, mm-hmm. does that make you want to get out and serve as a role model?
I don't know. I think I don't really know if I see myself as a role model in that way. I do see myself as someone who has inspired people. And because I'm true to my art, the next thing I do they might not like, you know what I mean? So when you're an artist, you have to be ready for that. It's not the same thing as being a politician or a doctor or a lawyer. You really have to be ready that the person, you know, some of the people who like Push hated the kid because the kid deals not just with a victim, it deals with a victimizer. Many people were not ready to deal with that. So in that way, you know sometimes people are with you, sometimes it's like a musician. They might like one record, they might not like the other. But I think what you can hold out to is if you've been true to your vision, you can hold out that you've lived a life that is true to your art and that they can live lives that are true to what they believe in. And I think in that way we can, any person who's working hard and can live a life that can be considered a model for other people. And the other thing I think is we are, at least my generation, is not part of the silent generation. So we had years and years of silent suffering and all this from women. And so now we have a vocal quality to women that we haven't had in the past. And I think Hillary Clinton is part of that. Michelle Obama is part of that. And I think, you know, we can look outside of this country. I don't think there's been a greater leader in this than Angela Merkel. You know what I mean? Germany could have gone back to their past, which is horrific, but the way she took risk and opened up to the immigrants coming from Syria and different places, no one expected that from her, you know what I mean? And so I think that she has truly, been a role model in addition to having run a country. You know, she's doing what Hillary wants to do. And so that can teach us. It can be done. You know what I mean?
That was author and poet Sapphire at SUNY Ulster in New York's Hudson Valley. Her first two novels are Push and The Kid. Pope Francis is allowing all priests to absolve the faithful of the, quote, grave sin of abortion, extending indefinitely the special permission he had granted for the duration of the recently ended Holy Year of Mercy. Francis wrote in a document made public by the Vatican that there is no sin that God's mercy cannot reach and wipe away when it finds a repentant heart, while staunchly reiterating that abortion is a grave sin since it puts an end to innocent life. A top Holy See official told a news conference at the Vatican that the Pope's words applied also to those who were involved in an abortion, from the women to the nurse to the doctor and whoever supports the procedure. And here's a female first. A veteran state trooper and her rookie daughter have become the first mother and daughter to serve in uniform at the same time in the nearly century-long history of the New York State Police. Trooper Megan Hartman graduated from the State Police Academy, joining her mother, Bethany Lamphere, as a uniformed trooper. The mother and daughter work at separate stations 60 miles apart in central New York. Lamphere was already a mother of three children, ages 6, 10, and 12, when she became a trooper in 2001. Her career has included a 2-year stint as an investigator. The state police, founded in 1917, accepted its first women recruits in 1973. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1428.